Midnight GMT. Hello, I'm Roger Hearing, and this is Business Matters on the BBC World Service. We're connecting the time zones. Today we're live in Philadelphia and Bangkok. Coming up on today's programme, Britain's embattled Prime Minister invites the opposition leader in for talks in a last-ditch attempt to find some way ahead on Brexit.
She's going to try and reach out to Jeremy Corbyn and try and find a way forward, but she's going to have to seek a short delay to do that.
Also, the Thailand smog that's making finance ministers and central bankers cough. The incredible shrinking living space in Britain, and Hong Kong's plans to build a new island to take its expanding population. That's Business Matters here on the BBC, coming up after the latest news.
This is the BBC News. Hello, I'm Jonathan Izard. The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, has said she will ask the European Union for an extension to the Brexit deadline to give time to break the impasse in Parliament and leave the bloc with a deal. Naomi Grimley explains.
Theresa May has finally changed tack on Brexit. She wants to ask the EU for an extension to the Brexit deadline up until the 22nd of May. She's also signalling she will sit down formally with the leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, who has suggested the UK stays in a customs union with the EU. Remaining in the customs union crosses one of her previous red lines, and it may also mean resignations from her cabinet.
Leading Brexiteers in the governing Conservative Party have reacted to Mrs. May's move with anger and dismay. The former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson said Brexit was becoming soft to the point of disintegration and added that it now seemed likely that key law-making powers would be handed over to Brussels. Some Brexiteers said that they were already receiving resignation emails from Conservative Party members in their constituency. There's been a broad but guarded welcome in Brussels to Mrs. May's attempt to reach a cross-party consensus on Brexit. The Danish Prime Minister, Lars Løkke Rasmussen, appealed for patience to see if there was suddenly a way forward. The European Parliament's Brexit coordinator, Guy Verhofstadt, described Mrs. May's move as better late than never. But the French Foreign Minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, said he was still waiting for a clear position from London. The president of Algeria, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, has announced that he's resigned with immediate effect following weeks of protests against his earlier decision to stand for a fifth term. Louise de Wast has the details.
Protesters got what they wanted, President Bouteflika's resignation without major violence in the country. The demonstration started on February 22nd when the president announced he would seek a fifth term in office. Finally, Algeria's powerful army chief of staff called for the president's immediate resignation. And hours later, the country's state news agency reported he had notified the Constitutional Council that he was resigning.
Police in Los Angeles say a suspect in the murder of the American rapper Nipsey Hussle has been arrested. David Willis reports.
The Los Angeles Police Department said in a statement that the man suspected of killing Nipsey Hussle has now been arrested. They'd previously identified a man called Eric Holder as a suspect and issued a picture of him. A call from a member of the public led to the arrest in a suburb of Los Angeles. The shooting in broad daylight triggered an outpouring of grief amongst the rapper's peers, who hailed both his musical talent and his community work.
This is the World News from the BBC.
Hello and welcome to Business Matters. I'm Roger Hearing. Coming up on the programme today, the latest desperate move of Theresa May, reaching out to her main political opponents in the UK to try to rescue Brexit. We'll also be hearing about the curse of student loan debt in the US and Hong Kong's $40 billion plan to build a new island to ease its housing crisis.
30% people need to be rehoused in the next decade. And you can't move these people outside of Hong Kong to China. So the government, that's why they need really a new place.
And I'll be joined throughout the programme by two guests on opposite sides of the Pacific. Nisid Hajjari, Asia editor for Bloomberg's editorial board, joining us on the line from Bangkok. And Maya Rossum, editor of, or director, I should say, of the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, also an environmentalist and a lawyer who's in Philadelphia. So Nisid, first of all, after you, I'll say a very good evening.
Well, good morning here.
Good morning. I'm getting it the wrong way around, aren't I? Yes, good morning to you. And across the other side of the world, in Philadelphia, Maya, it's good evening to you.
Yes, good evening.
Anyway, welcome both of you, and thanks very much indeed for joining us. Now, an apology to start with. For all of you sick to death of Brexit stories, I'm sorry. But in the last few hours, the UK Prime Minister Theresa May has made an important announcement. She said she would seek to forge a common position with the leader of the opposition Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, and if that didn't work, to try to find out what Parliament could accept and take that forward. And in the meantime, could Europe please grant her another extension to Britain's leaving date?
Today, I am taking action to break the logjam. I'm offering to sit down with the leader of the opposition and to try to agree a plan that we would both stick to ensure that we leave the European Union and that we do so with a deal. Any plan would have to agree the current withdrawal agreement. It has already been negotiated with the 27 other members, and the EU has repeatedly said that it cannot and will not be reopened.
So what does all this mean for the frankly interminable Brexit process? Lizzie Buchan is political correspondent with the Independent newspaper here in London. So where does Theresa May's announcement leave us?
The thing with Theresa May is often when she does these statements, they leave more questions than they answer. The gist of what she said tonight is that she is reaching out to Jeremy Corbyn in what we think is quite a serious offer to try and find a way to break what she called the Brexit logjam. And she said that she will seek a short extension to the Article 50 process, which is the two-year negotiation process, so that they can find a sort of way forward that is acceptable to Parliament. We know that the UK is due to leave the EU on April the 12th, next Friday, currently without a deal unless Theresa May goes to the EU and asks for an extension next week. So she's basically saying to her party and to the rest of Parliament that she's prepared to seek that extension, so she's not planning to pursue a no-deal Brexit, which some of the more sort of hard-line Eurosceptics in her party would like her to do. Instead, she's going to try and reach out to Jeremy Corbyn and try and find a way forward, but she's going to have to seek a short delay to do that.
But we've no idea still what that way forward might be. A softer Brexit, a customs union, what they call Common Market 2.0. I mean, any idea of which of these might go forward?
Well, the Labour have got a very, well, they think it's a very specific plan, which includes membership of a customs union, protections around standards, including sort of workers' rights and that sort of thing, enshrined within that agreement. So if Theresa May is reaching out to Jeremy Corbyn, she obviously is going to have to talk to him around those areas, and she knows it. And that's quite interesting because one of her most significant red lines, as she calls them, has always been a customs union, because she really believes that Brexit means that the UK should be able to conduct its own independent trade deals around the world rather than being kind of bound to what the EU has done, as we have done before.
And all this, of course, will depend on the European Union agreeing to a further extension. Are we sure they'll do that?
We're certainly not sure. I mean, it's something that would need to be rubber stamped by the 27 other member states. They have in the past suggested that they would be open to agreeing a delay to the process. They really don't want a no-deal Brexit either. And, you know, they've been, Donald Tusk in particular, has been sort of quite open to that. And you had Emmanuel Macron talking today, sort of saying that the EU cannot be held hostage to a political crisis in the UK. But he also made clear that, you know, if we wanted an extension for something meaningful, then that is something he could support. So if we keep going back and saying, you know, oh, can we have a short extension, maybe 6 weeks, 2 months, it's not entirely likely that they will back it, because the EU has other things that it wants to deal with.
Lizzie Buchan there of The Independent. Well, from one embarrassed government to another, Thailand is having a bit of a red face moment just over a week after its election. There's a meeting of finance ministers and central bankers from the countries of the regional bloc ASEAN in the northern city of Chiang Rai. And now Thai officials are having to hand out face masks to the delegates. because air pollution there has reached alarming levels. The reason is a haze caused by farmers burning agricultural byproducts like rice straws. Dry vegetation caused by recent weather patterns is also thought to have contributed. Well, a rather angry Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha has ordered the problem dealt with within 7 days. Witsano Atanovich is an economics professor at Kasetit University in Bangkok, and I asked him what he made of the Thai government's response to the crisis.
I think it should be better the resources that the government have, whether the person or the money will go to the northern part of Thailand to solve the problem. I think it's possible, but I'm not sure whether in the long run, after 7 days, the situation will be get better.
What is it that's causing this? I mean, why now? We're used to the idea of big smogs in Indonesia, Malaysia, but why now and from northern Thailand?
The source comes from the forest burning. Farmers, they burn their agricultural residuals. And also maybe if we link with the climate, 2 years ago, we faced with La Niña. So that means the forest, they're going to have a lot of biomass. And now we face with El Nino, the weather will be dry, drought happened. So now we have forest fire and we have a lot of biomass in the forest. So that's why this year the situation get worse as compared to previous years.
And what about the future? I mean, you said, you know, yes, you could sort it out in 7 days, but then it would come back. What is the long-term solution to this?
Farmers, they need to burn agricultural residuals. The point here is there is no money. They have a zero value. So in economics, the pollution happened because there is no price, no market for them. So if we want to solve the pollution, we need to create the market so that you can have the market for rice store. If they can give the rice store to the livestock sector, and in this case, the farmers will not burn.
Witsano Atanovich then. Nisid, I mean, how big a problem is air pollution in Bangkok or in Thailand generally?
It's gotten much worse this year. Earlier in January and February this year in Bangkok, the pollution levels spiked, which they can do at this time of year because of the weather patterns, as the guest said. But this year, they lasted much longer than usual. And for the first time, you know, middle-class Thais really started to get upset. Schools were closed. Everybody's walking around with masks. And the government sort of did the same thing, these kind of immediate gesture, spraying water in the air and things to try and clear the air that were visual but weren't attacking the systemic problems that need to be addressed.
And Maya, I mean, you know, your latest book's called The Green Amendment. I mean, one of the interesting things about the professor was talking about, you know, about dealing with this is in effect setting up a kind of economy. If you buy things that people would otherwise burn and find a way of selling them off, that's a way of avoiding having them burn. It's almost using the economy to try and achieve these things. Is that something you can sympathize with?
Well, absolutely. But, you know, in different countries, we have different primary sources causing the air pollution. And using the economy to find solutions is an important pathway. But we also have to use regulation, because the fact of the matter is that air pollution in the United States and across the world is very literally killing people and certainly impacting their lives and their health in devastating ways, including for children, compromising their ability to even learn, let alone causing asthma attacks and having long-term health consequences. So we really need to use a wide array of solutions. Some of it's going to be economic, but some of it's got to be regulation.
Well, I was going to say, with the regulation in this case, is they're already there. It's illegal what they're doing. It hasn't stopped them.
Well, certainly in that case, I'm more focused just what's happening worldwide. And the fact of the matter is that different countries have different causes and are going to require a different set of solutions. But we've got to use the full array to the full extent possible wherever we are.
OK, well, I'm sure it's a subject we'll be coming back to again and again, I'm sure. Now, we're going to talk about the issues of population and space. Now, do you ever get that shrinking feeling? If you live in the United Kingdom, it's a very real sensation. At around 68 square metres, homes built in the last decade are nearly 20% smaller than they were in the 1970s. A growing population and the high cost of land mean that many of us are having to squeeze into tighter spaces. We sent Elizabeth Hodson to Kensington Olympia here in London to visit the Ideal Home Show, now in its 111th year, to see how that space can be used better.
At the 1975 Ideal Home Exhibition, as it used to be known, guests were invited to luxuriate in some rather spacious surroundings.
In the Davis home, designer Anne de Courcy shows the advantages of a large modern kitchen.
Fast forward to 2019, and it's a rather different story, as I found out at this year's show. London's a city where space is at a premium. Here and in other urban centres around the world, people are having to adapt to modern living conditions. And one of the current buzzwords in the construction industry is modular housing. That's a home built off-site and delivered to the final location after it's been completed. And if I look 20 metres into the centre of the hall, there's a prime example of modular housing. It's a two-storey, full-sized house called the Evolving Home. And the architect, David Richards, is going to show me around.
Modular housing is big in areas like China and America. The thing about steel frame housing is that you can do everything in the factory. You can connect the plumbing. And what you do is when you go to site, it's all about plug and play. You literally plug into the next module and you can build them side by side. You can build them on top of each other. And these can now be built up to 21 levels. So you're looking at office blocks, you're looking at student accommodation.
And as housing costs increase, modular homes can be adapted to accommodate extra inhabitants.
What we're entering is what we call the boomerang area of the house. This is where, you know, the sons, the daughters have gone to college, they've gone to university, they then move back to their parents' home. So this has been adapted with their own kitchen, with their own living space, their own bathroom space.
But it's not just the boomerang generation whose reality and expectations have changed, according to Karen Walker from Good Homes magazine.
We've seen that houses are definitely becoming a lot smaller than they used to be. Open plan living is a big thing for us. No dining rooms either. I mean, years ago, my parents always had a separate dining room. We had a separate dining room and it was your place where you just ate your dinner. And that was it. But now you go into any house and you'll see that as being as a family room or it's a space where the kids go.
And as house prices have become unaffordable for young people, especially in a lot of big cities around the world, how have people's expectations of homes changed?
Spaces need to work twice as hard as they used to now. I think loft spaces are becoming areas that people are now carving up to make two or three rooms. You know, we really have to think about the way we use our homes.
Lack of space may be more pressing nowadays, but back in 1975, it was an issue for some homeowners.
You'd swear some of the exhibits were optical illusions. For the serious drinker, how about a bar with a built-in bed? Not the best thing for a hangover.
I just hope there was some aspirin in that bedside cabinet.
Ah, the joys of small spaces. Well, lack of space isn't just a problem there. In Hong Kong, a growing population and limited space inside the territory have led to a radical plan to build a new artificial island to try to ease the housing crisis. It's going to provide 1,000 hectares of extra land just off the biggest current island, Lantau. But the $40 billion project has met with fierce opposition on environmental as well as economic grounds. But one of the idea's proponents is Geng Zhao, who's Professor of Practice in Finance at Peking University HSBC Business School.
Well, you know, in Hong Kong, actually, we need a lot of housing, not just for the young people, you know, who get married, but also 30% of the housing actually already too old needs to be rebuilt. Some people might choose to live cross-border in China, but still, a lot of people want to stay in Hong Kong. So that's why the idea to build this artificial island were actually proposed originally by then British government. But now this is really very timely because the island location is actually between the airport and Hong Kong and also the Hong Kong-Macau and Zhuhai Bridge. So it's really a very economically efficient and socially beneficial project.
Well, you say it's economically desirable or efficient, but I've seen reports it will cost up to 624 billion Hong Kong dollars. That's around 100 billion US dollars. And it's a huge amount of money for Hong Kong to spend.
Yes, you know, Hong Kong have a 2.5-year fiscal surplus. Hong Kong has no debt. And also the housing prices are so expensive that on the margin, any increase in the land is going to be basically increase the efficiency of the island.
But it's,
so it's like Manhattan.
But it's also, obviously, it's an area that's very crowded at the moment. But I've seen, again, reports suggesting that there's at least 1,200 hectares of brownfield sites, sites inside Hong Kong that could be redeveloped without having to do this, without having to make this new island.
Well, if you look at the map, that's true. But, you know, Hong Kong, basically, it's a lot of hills. And also, you know, there are some areas which, you know, it's basically not fitted for building, you know, cities. There are also a lot of historical problems on land, which under the basic law in Hong Kong, it's very difficult to deal with.
So the real problems with this seem to me to be cost, but you think in the end this will be a net benefit to Hong Kong?
Yes, you know, think about 30% people needs to be rehoused in the next decade, and you can't move these people outside of Hong Kong to China. So the government, that's why they need really a new place. You know, I teach at the universities, you know, 20 years ago, the graduates gets 20,000 Hong Kong dollar a month, and today it's the same. But housing price increased 3-4 times. So that's why this is really a necessity, you know, to give Hong Kong a good future.
Professor Geng Shao. So obviously the uniting factor is, in both those stories, is how do you deal with too many people and too little space. Maya, I mean, that is a big problem, and it obviously does have huge environmental implications, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm so glad in the interview that the question about brownfields was raised, because that's not a solution that's been proposed by outsiders. That's a solution that's being proposed by experts inside Hong Kong and becomes a solution that will both serve the housing needs in the community, but also protect the environment at the same time.
We should add brownfield is things that have already been built on in the past or used in the past, not sort of fresh land, as it were.
Absolutely. And generally, a brownfield site is a site that's been contaminated and is no longer deemed easily usable. It's site these tend to be areas, at least in the U.S., that need environmental cleanup. So rather than abandon them in a contaminated condition, we go, we clean them up, take care of whatever their toxic problem is, and then we reuse them in this beneficial way for other purposes. In this case, the experts are talking about housing, which is apparently desperately needed.
And you think that's a much better idea than building fresh land, completely fresh land in the sea?
Yeah, and I don't really look at it as building fresh land. I look at it as taking away the sea, right? Taking away critical habitat for fishes and fisheries, which, by the way, are very important for the fishing industry. So when you talk about it being economically efficient to fill in the ocean to create land, I guess it depends who you are. The fisher folk, the fishing industry, probably don't consider it to be so economically efficient.
Nisit, how does Bangkok cope with overpopulation? Because it's another very growing city without all that room it can expand into.
It is, but it has a lot more room than, say, Hong Kong does. I mean, it's a very spread out city. So what happens is people just, you know, move further and further out in search of affordable housing. So the problem is what you need to do is create more robust public transportation networks so that people can get to the center of the city. In the center, what you have is a lot of building, a lot of high-scale, high-income condo building, but a lot of that's being sold to foreign buyers, to, you know, Chinese investors and so on, and not being used by Thais to live in.
And also people are living in the sort of waterways as well, aren't they, in quite unpleasant conditions. I mean, isn't part of the reason for that the fact there isn't available housing?
Part of it's tradition, part of it's income, obviously. It's the housing that is being built. Again, it's being built for a different market. People are developers are looking to make money off of, you know, wealthier investors rather than trying to find, you know, to house locals.
I suppose part of the thing with all this is space. I mean, you mentioned just then about taking away from the sea, but in the US, obviously, you have an awful lot of space still. So the necessity to use sites that have previously been used or even to find ways of perhaps building high isn't quite as much as it would be in, say, a lot of European cities.
Well, one may perceive it differently, I guess. But actually here in the U.S., in terms of the cities, there are tremendous efforts to actually reclaim these brownfield sites. One, in order to reuse those lands beneficially within the city borders, right, where people want to develop economically, but also because environmentally it's very important to get whatever dangerous condition exists on the site actually cleaned up so that we're not contaminating drinking water supplies or air or threatening nearby populations. So it really is beneficial both environmentally but also in terms of providing the opportunity for additional development in those places and spaces where people want it. Because we have to remember, the more we spread out, right, the more natural habitats, forests and wetlands and meadows that we're eating up. And that's not good either.
Well, Nissit, isn't that really the point? That perhaps we're too lavish in our use of space. I mean, as Elizabeth Hodson sort of discovered in her piece, that, you know, perhaps we just need to live in smaller spaces.
Well, that's part of it, right? I mean, there are you know, massive economic efficiencies associated with density, right? Cities are the environmentally better way to live. If you look at a place like Singapore, for instance, which you don't think of as a dense city, it's actually one of the densest countries on Earth because it's a small country. And the way they handle it is by housing people in public housing that is very dense, and then leaving lots of green space between them.
Yeah, well, there are lots of ways of dealing with it, but Hong Kong is going for building in the sea. Anyway, stay with us. Much more coming up here on Business Matters in just a moment. We're going to be talking about student debt. Welcome back to Business Matters with me, Roger Hearing, and my guest today, Nissit Hajjari and Maya Van Rossum. Now, there's a student debt crisis in the United States. Americans now owe more in college loans than they do on their credit cards. Around 45 million Americans now owe a total of more than $1.5 trillion. That's about $520 billion more than the total credit card debt. Now, most of that money is owed to the government through the federal student loan system. The rest is owed to private lenders, often at much higher rates of interest. In the US, in contrast to countries like the UK, student loans don't get cancelled after a fixed number of years. It's debt which is almost impossible to get cancelled, even if you've been declared bankrupt. Listen to 24-year-old Melissa Haggerty. She's from Chicago. To get to university, she took on loans both federal and private, totaling $140,000.
Today I owe about $170,000. I make monthly payments and it increases instead of decreases. So that's because my private loans have such a high interest rate. It's about 11%. It's sort of like a crushing feeling. I'm doing all I can do. I'm working a middle-class job, and, you know, they're asking me for $1,400 a month just for my private loans, which is more than my rent.
Melissa Haggerty. Well, on the other side of America, in the Californian city of Watsonville, is Rosemary Anderson. She's from a different generation. She's 62. Her struggle to free herself from what she owes has lasted 25 years and counting. She decided to go to university in her early 30s, hoping a degree would improve her chances of getting a better job. But that dream has turned into a financial nightmare.
I was working in social services at the time, and I took a leave of absence from my job to care for my brother who was dying of AIDS. And over the course of the next 6 weeks of making that decision, my brother passed away, and I lost my job. And so I decided to go back to school and to get my degree. So when I first took out the loans, my undergraduate degree and my graduate degree combined was around $64,000 for both. And that was approximately 25 years ago. And now that amount is over $160,000. I am paying close to $1,000 a month towards that debt. And that doesn't really ever pay down the principal. It doesn't touch the principal, and it only barely touches the interest that has accumulated over the course of that 25 years. I will never pay it off.
Rosemary.
Ever.
Rosemary Anderson there. The problem is clear, but what's the solution? Well, last month, the White House proposed a package of measures, including a cap on the amount of money that can be loaned to students. For Ben Miller at the Center for American Progress in Washington, the key is how university education is funded.
We already have caps on loans for undergraduates, and that hasn't done anything to arrest the growth in tuition. If we want to keep college prices from rising, we need to return to a world where the cost of college is equally shared between the federal government, the student, and states. You know, we used to have a deal in this country that if you went to a public higher education institution, the state would be kicking in most of the cost of delivering that education for you. You would pay a reasonable share, and the federal government would step in with grants and a little bit of loan debt to help those who needed it. And that's just totally broken down.
Ben Miller there. Maya, is this a familiar story to you?
Sadly, it is. I know all too many people that are suffering in this way. And my husband and I went to great lengths to ensure that my daughter didn't have to bear the burden of this crushing debt as she graduates from college in just a month or two.
How did you do that? Just making sure?
We had to take out a loan on our home. We had to refinance our home in order to be able to have the money to pay for her to go to college for 4 years, which is an incredibly significant burden. On the other hand, it's one that we can manage over time, but my daughter wouldn't be able to manage $140,000 of debt.
Nisit, I know. I mean, you were educated in the States, weren't you?
Grew up there.
Nisit, sorry, we didn't hear that.
No. Yeah, sorry, I grew up in the U.S. and was educated there.
Did you have student loans? Was that part of the deal at the time or not?
It was. But I went to university I was fortunate to go to a very rich university, to Princeton, and they have means-blind admissions. So they, I got a package of financial aid that involved me working, had taking on some debt, and also getting some grants. Mm-hmm. But they, had the financial resources to be able to do that for their students.
How does it work in somewhere like Thailand? I mean, I know in Britain there's a big issue about how students finance their degrees and loans and the rest of it. Does Thailand have a system, or do people just pay if they can and not if they don't?
I'm not terribly familiar with the Thai system. The problem across Asia generally is that parents everywhere want to get the best education for their kids, and it's not necessarily available through public education. So they're spending a lot of money on tutoring services, on private schools, on English language education. And this is true from, poorer countries like India to very rich countries like South Korea. So household debt in a lot of these places is rising in large part because of spending on education.
It's an interesting issue. I mean, Maya, what is the alternative to this? I mean, in Britain, up until about 20 years ago, certainly in my time, many people went through college and it was all paid for by the state. And then someone said, well, hang on, why should ordinary working people be paying for someone else to have an education to get themselves a better job? And the system changed. Is it time to go back to a wholly state-funded system? Is it even possible?
I'm not sure what exactly the solution is, but that's certainly a very important part of the solution. It can't all be about private loans and private debt. This, the community as a whole, right? Our country as a whole, all countries benefit when we have better educated people contributing to our economy, contributing to society, contributing in any number of ways. And so society benefits, and therefore it makes sense for society to contribute. And, one of the things I want to point out, when kids are getting out of school with this crushing debt, their entire focus is going to be getting those higher paying jobs, right? So they can pay off that debt. And that actually becomes a loss to society, because those important social services like teaching and environmental protection and working for the government, all of those things go by the wayside, and the best and the brightest are going off trying to make money to pay off their debt. And we don't have people really doing the socially good work that is beneficial to us all. So clearly, we all benefit by having a well-educated population. And so the government absolutely must contribute in very significant ways, if not entirely, which is what some Democratic candidates here in the U.S. are suggesting.
Nisit, what do you think is the best way to run this kind of thing? I mean, is the loan system as it is the best way?
I think that's going to have to be part of it, but I agree. I think there's got to be a much more public investment in education. This is, again, the specifics will be different based on each country and the fiscal situation of the government and what's needed. I mean, it's a daunting prospect in a place like India, where you've, just underinvested in education for decades now, and trying to get started at this point will be very, very difficult. But it does have to be done. Then you also, again, have to create the jobs that are appropriate for these graduates. So a big problem in China, in India, is that you have overqualified people, but you don't have the jobs available that they expect when they graduate.
And the problem with that also is that if you have a system where obviously there's a huge financial burden, it will tend to be only the rich that go to university and in effect perpetuates a class system. Doesn't have the most talented people, but the richest people in those positions.
Right, exactly. It's self-sorting. So people, and you get this in the U.S. as well. I mean, people move to cities, to school districts where the schools are better, and then those students tend to do better than other students, and then they, of course, get better jobs and so on. And so it gets perpetuated generationally.
But Maya, I mean, the obvious question that I guess some people are screaming at the radio is, hang on, society, you know, we can't afford to pay people to do this. We, you know, if you have a large number of people going to university, and the idea certainly here in Britain is a very broad area of people who can go to university, you can't afford through taxes to pay for them to do it.
Of course we can, right? There are many social needs that we as society benefit from and we choose to invest in, right? And so it's figuring out what's the right balance and figuring out how to make it happen. But just, you know, there are so many social services that are critically important, and education is a fundamentally important aspect of everybody's lives. It's a fundamentally important aspect of a successful society.
Is it a right? Should it be a human right to have higher education?
I believe education, I believe proper health care, I believe clean water, clean air, and a healthy environment are all fundamental rights that should be protected just as vigorously as we protect other fundamental rights that we hold dear, like freedom of religion and freedom of speech, for example.
Nissa, do you agree? I mean, do you think it is a right for everyone who wants to, who has the capacity to benefit from going to university, to be able to do that?
I do agree. And I think also, you know, if you want to think of it in more selfish terms, this is what countries need, right? Thailand, for instance, you know, this is a country which is looking to move up the manufacturing ladder from, you know, into more advanced sectors. And to do that, you need skilled workers. And you have like in many places, a shrinking labor force as the population ages. You need workers that are educated. And the biggest problem that Thailand faces, and the World Bank and other people have been talking about this for years now, is the quality of its education. If you don't have, if you're not creating the workers to power your economy, the entire country is going to suffer. So it's good for you in the end.
And that leads me to an interesting point, Maya, which is that if we are educating people at that sort of level, a lot of people feel that they don't want to go into that, particularly if they're going to have a burden of debt, unless they are doing something that's very focused on their vocation. So all the things that perhaps one would like to study at university, I don't know, reading poetry, studying literature, studying philosophy, are not the kind of things that people will go for because that's not going to pay their debt back.
Exactly. And that's part of the problem, right? People are not following their passion. They're not following what they're good at. They're simply trying to study what's going to get them the best paying job, whether or not it's good for them and whether or not it's really what society ultimately needs from them. So what we really want to do is give people the opportunity to explore the pathway that is most beneficial to them and their quality of life. And in the end, we will end up with those workers who are smarter and better and more passionate about doing the job that best helps us as a society, whether it's teaching or machinery or plumbing, whatever it is, right?
Well, let me,
we want people to follow their passion.
Well, let me put that back, Nissa, because you were talking very much about the economic benefit of having people in higher education. But the same point there, I suppose, if they are, studying ancient Persian, they're not necessarily going to be the people who will most obviously go into jobs that are going to earn large amounts of money or make the country more economically viable.
No, I mean, that is true. But you know, there's a range, obviously. You know, I was a liberal arts major. I'm a huge believer in the virtue of that. And that will be the right choice for many people. But, you know, it's true here. It's true in the U.S. It's true elsewhere. You know, we do need more STEM graduates.
This is to do with technology and science.
Exactly. Science, technology, mathematics. You know, that's just true globally because of the way the world is shifting and the advent of technology. So, you know, and in some places, you know, again, like in India, some of the highest youth unemployment is among graduates, people with college degrees, and that's because they are waiting for jobs that don't exist. And if you can create and sort of a vocational education that is respected and that is solid and that gives people skills they need, that's just another avenue people could pursue.
And one that perhaps society should pay for. Now, it's that moment in the programme where we link up with one of our reporters around the world today. It's Nick Beek, live on the line from Myanmar. Nick, a bit of a crisis in Rakhine, that's the area in the far west of Myanmar. What's going on?
Hello, Roger. Yes, well, we'll remember that Rakhine State was the place, you know, that the international community was focusing on back in August 27 when the Rohingya crisis erupted. Because at that point, 750,000 Rohingya Muslims fled that place after the Burmese army launched this brutal crackdown on them. And since then, we've seen a tension shift across the border with the refugees themselves to Bangladesh, where, you know, nearly a million Rohingya refugees now languish in the camps. But what we've seen in Rakhine State, the very same place in the past 3 or 4 months, is another eruption of violence. It's not on the same level and it hasn't got the same dynamics as before, but it is really concerning for at least more than a dozen international non-governmental organisations, charities, who are saying that nearly 100,000 people are living without any access to outside help from charities. Healthcare, education and clean water have all been jeopardised because of this recent fighting. So real concern.
No ability of the UN. I mean, the UN rapporteur, I know, in the area has complained in the past of no access. Presumably you can't get access to this either.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, there's not access for people who'd want to see what's happening on the ground in terms of potential war crimes. There's not access for journalists to look at what's happening. But, you know, more importantly, there is not this crucial access for people from the international community who may want to help people caught in the crossfire. Because what we've seen in the last 3 or 4 months is violence carried out between the National Army, Myanmar's army, and rebels from the AA. And what's interesting here and makes things so much more difficult is the AA, or Arakan Army, they're actually ethnic Rakhine people, so they're predominantly Buddhist. This is not anyone linked to the Rohingya community and the militants who first hit those security posts back in 2017. So you've got a really complicated picture here, but it's pretty simple in terms of civilians of all ethnicities, of all religions, are caught in the middle, and there is a concern that lots of people are being displaced by this and the fighting continuing around them.
And again, we've talked in the past when it was involving the Rohingyas, of course, of seeming silence from Aung San Suu Kyi and the civilian government. So again, it's the army leading all this and not really involving the civilian government.
I think that they're definitely leading it, the army. And what we've seen, which is interesting because it marks a departure from previously, we've heard Aung San Suu Kyi's government's spokesman deem the rebels in this case as being terrorists and has said that the government has vowed to help crush these rebels. So bearing in mind that this is an administration that has said since it came to power 3 years ago now that building a constructive and lasting peace for the country was a number one priority. That sort of language seems pretty tough to a lot of people. And we've had peace talks on the periphery take place but come to nothing, really. And so, yes, the army is leading this, but the government in this respect does seem to be giving their support to the army, whereas before, with the Rohingya crisis, they were criticised for not doing anything. So not really siding with the army, but basically standing back and leaving the Rohingya people to their fate. And, you know, it is extremely worrying. And also, this is a part of the world that, if you step back a little bit, they were hoping that this would be a tourist destination, Rakhine State. This is the great irony of it. They were hoping for UNESCO heritage status around some parts of the area because it's rich in architectural history, archaeology, some of the temples you've got there, amazing histories going back through time. But the picture, you know, looking forward, looks pretty, pretty bleak, Roger.
Nick, thanks very much for talking to us. That was Nick Beek, live on the line from Myanmar. Now, reports of the death of the music industry seem to have been exaggerated. The age of the internet and free music, which followed in its wake, led to plummeting revenue for artists and the labels they work for. At an event in London in the last 24 hours, though, the grandly named International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, or IFPI, has been celebrating something of a turnaround, especially an increase of more than a third in the amount of money earned from streaming over the past year. Our reporter Benji Guy was there.
I've come down to the Soho Hotel in central London for the release of the IFPI Global Music Report, where a number of big players have come to give their thoughts on the latest trends in the music industry. Global recorded music revenues have grown 9.7% in the last year, the fourth consecutive year of growth, after a difficult period for the industry. Francis Moore is chief executive of IFPI.
We were one of the first industries to go into that digital revolution, and it was a tough time. We had almost 15 years of decline, and I think it was dealing well with that transition that allowed us to be where we are today.
So what's behind this year's growth? There's only one answer: streaming, the revenue from which has grown 34%.
It clearly is a very convenient, very enjoyable way of accessing music. And so, it is taking off. 47% of total global revenues are now coming from streaming. And the potential is huge. I mean, we're nowhere near the end. There are countries opening up now like South Korea, China, and also Africa. The sky's the limit.
With streaming becoming more accessible across the globe, it means we're being exposed to music we may never have heard before. Adam Granite is Executive Vice President of Market Development at Universal Music Group.
I think with streaming, you see repertoire now traveling around the world like never before. And so we're seeing music, whether it's from South Korea or from Latin America, reach global audiences, which is pretty unique from a historical standpoint in the industry.
Massive growth in Latin American and Asian music. Could that be summed up in two words, reggaeton and K-pop?
Those are both huge parts of the story, whether that's BTS. Who had a huge year last year, or J Balvin from Colombia, who had also a huge year. But I think as well there's lots of different artists, whether it's Chinese artists or artists from the Philippines or artists from all over Latin America or Spain. It's not one market, it's not one sound, and I think really we're seeing a diversity like never before, which is incredibly exciting.
A hit on one side of the world can top the charts on the other, even if the lyrics aren't understood. Stu Bergen is CEO of International and Global Commercial Services at Warner Music Group.
Music connects with people on many different levels, you know, emotional, lyrical, guttural. It makes you dance, it makes you cry, it makes you laugh. And I think that sometimes a good melody is a good melody, a good beat is a good beat. It's not always about the lyrics. To reference a time going back a ways, one of the most culturally significant songs in the 90s was Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana. If you walk down the street and ask 97% of the people to articulate the lyrics of Smells Like Teen Spirit, I think they'd be quite challenged. But ultimately, it affected people deeply and shifted music in a pretty profound way, but I don't think it was necessarily just about a connection to lyrics, and that's why people can appreciate music in different languages.
Where's the next global music hit going to come from?
I think you'll see more songs coming out of Asia. I think you'll see Afrobeat coming out of Africa. If I had a specific answer, we would have already signed it and you'd be listening to it.
Right, that's it. I'm off to go and pen the next Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style.
Quite enough of that, I think. That was Benji Guy reporting there. Okay, now, Nisid, we've heard K-pop. What about Thai pop? Is there any?
There is, although some of it is derivative of K-pop. I mean, all across East Asia, Korea is just dominant when it comes to pop culture. So, you know, it used to be Canto pop from Hong Kong, and now K-pop influences everybody.
So why not Thailand? I mean, you're thinking this is a country with an enormously vibrant culture in the background. I mean, surely they can produce the same better stuff than the Koreans.
There's some very interesting stuff here. There's, you know, Thai traditional country music is this music called Molam music that, you know, involves some, you know, uniquely Thai instruments. And there are bands that are updating this, adding, you know, electric guitar and you know, rock riffs to it. So I think what you'll find is all over the world, as these bands find audiences that are broader than their locality, you'll find more experimentation like that and more interesting fusions that you will have audiences across the world.
Well, exactly. As you say, Meyer, it is the streaming that's kind of liberating in that sense. You can literally on your phone conjure up anything from anywhere. I mean, you could be listening to Thai pop soon.
Well, I suppose it's liberating for some people, but streaming is definitely not for me. To me, music is my chance to get disconnected. And, you know, I don't want to have to be connected to my phone or to Wi-Fi or anything in order to enjoy some good music.
So, okay, so how do you
I'm
get
not
your music
a streaming
then?
One.
What do you do?
I download it onto my iPod, and I've got two little iPods that I can slip into my pocket very easily, and I go off on my merry way listening to my music.
That's
totally
old
disconnected
culture.
From
That's,
everything.
What's happened? How did you not, you know, how did you miss out? I mean, iPods? I mean, you know, that's out of the art now.
No, I'm way too connected all the time for work. When I listen to music, it's time to disconnect.
All right, and what do you listen to on these ancient pieces of technology?
Well, ancient music. Like, I love the Bee Gees, for example. Gosh. So.
Well, they probably first emerged on iPods and things, I guess. But,
no, well, before that, right? Records.
Oh, records. Yes, pieces of plastic. Nisit, I mean, when you get your music, okay, well, what music do you listen to, Nisit? I mean, not, I imagine, Thai country music.
Well, I do listen to some of that, but no, I had I'm a indie rock guy, and right. What I like about streaming is that I used to in a previous lifetime be a rock critic for an American magazine called Entertainment Weekly, back in the age of the CD. So I would have.
Gosh, what was the music then? Are we talking disco? No, surely not.
This was no. This was Nirvana, right? I'm from Seattle,
right. So that rang a bell with you, and when we were having Smells Like Teen Spirit, isn't it?
Exactly. But now instead of having record companies send me CDs to listen to, you know, the only way to find new music is to, you know, on streaming channels, you can punch in something you like. They give you suggestions for what else you might like. There are, you know, online radio stations that bring
in new what music. Is your favorite band at the moment? Come on, what's in your iPod, in your headphones recently?
You know, it's a good question because I keep putting on new music, so I'm not even sure I know the band. So
must be something.
I like
surely.
This
no?
song or that song.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and Maya, you're just sticking with the old stuff. Bee Gees forever.
No, not always. My daughter, right? She's a young hip gal. She recommends some more modern music for me, but then it always has to be about protecting the environment or doing some other good social justice things.
Now you've got to have fun on its own sometimes. Anyway, here's some fun music. Our theme tune. Bye-bye.